Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRV Health's Keith Figlioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back. This is the Healthcare is Hard podcast. Here with our great host, Keith Figlioli of LRV Health. Keith, how are you today?
I am doing terrific.
Excellent. Doing better than you were a few weeks ago when you were out to conduct this really stellar interview. Tell us a little bit about who are you talking to and about the fun you had along the way.
Yeah, it was kind of a fun one. Probably in the early days of this podcast, it was probably the most fun I've had yet. It's scrambling as well. So as you know, we interviewed Dr. Karen DeSalvo, who a lot of folks know. And I had the pleasure of having a couple of meetings out in Chicago. So I met her out there. She happened to be there as well. And so got really excited about getting out there, landed in O'Hare, drove out to the place we were going to meet, got to the place we were going to meet a little bit before she got there. And lo and behold, I forgot my recording equipment.
So I hate when that happens.
So in the best scrambling of all time, we actually, believe it or not, and I actually posted this on LinkedIn because it was so much fun, found a Chicago recording studio that did podcasts. And, you know, they slotted us in about an hour later and off to the races we went. And it was, I have to say, the big question I had in my mind is, why am I not doing this all the time? Because it was so much fun.
No, I think we'll have to look into that. Yeah, it was a funny in my end as well. I was in my car driving my kid to a doctor's appointment and we were going over our options. So it all worked out for the best because it really was a great conversation. And I think sitting down in a setting like that, and folks can see the picture, really allows for a relaxed conversation. So hit a few of the high points of your discussion with Karen DeSalvo.
So I think as most people know, Karen is really an completely dedicated to sort of public health in this country and this world, and spends a lot of her time around the country traveling a lot, frankly, dedicated to that effort and working with places like, and she happened to be in Chicago that day for a big AMA event around this. She's also doing some work with Levitt Partners on a special project around social determinants of health. And so I was just excited because the topic is so hot in the space right now. We've had some big funding news in the space right now. We've had an acquisition with Tab Health being bought by Signify in the space. And there's just a lot of movement in this space. So it was very sort of a current event, if you will. And Karen, better than anybody, has an incredible story going all the way back to being a resident. And then also working post-Katrina down in New Orleans and then with the city there. Just sort of really think about public health from a very different angle. And she's got more credibility than anybody I've really ever talked to on this topic, given these types of experiences. So it's just a terrific interview with a terrific person. And I think people are just going to really enjoy it because we start getting into the sort of internal side and the plumbing, and only as an insider would, of what this topic is really about, meaning social determinants of health, and what the country really needs to embrace to sort of move it forward and embrace sort of social care, social determinants in with sort of clinical care. So we have a united sort of front on how we think about people's health and well-being.
That's great. And I don't know if you get into it in the conversation or not, but she has a role at LRV, at least as an advisor. What is Karen DeSalvo doing with you folks?
Yeah, I've known Karen for a little bit of time, and we dig into these types of topics often from an investing standpoint. And so we recently added Karen as an advisor, one of our executive advisors. We have five executive advisors here at LRV Health that are prominent folks that have been in and around the space 20 to 30 to 40 years. And she's been an incredible addition and has been very helpful in terms of helping us sort of think about this space and what makes sense for our investors, which are healthcare systems and payers across the country, and also working with them to help them think about how they should be operationalizing social determinants of health within their organizations.
That's terrific. Well, let's get into this great conversation with Karen DeSalvo.
Well, here we are in a studio with Dr. Karen DeSalvo. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Keith?
Good. It's been a fun day trying to get into the studio and get the interview going today. So I can't remember which episode this is, but this is the Healthcare is Hard podcast. And we are coming off a little long Memorial Day weekend and getting back into it. And we're pretty excited about this. But just wanted to get started in a discussion with you, and can't thank you enough again to take the time to do this, because I know you're very, very busy.
Everybody is. That's part of our lives now, I guess.
Absolutely. But as I was just saying to you, you know, I always try to start this the same way, because I think it's really important for people to kind of understand a little bit more about you and your background. I think people know about sort of the here and now and some of the stuff back to Katrina and otherwise. But how did you get started in all this? How did you get started in healthcare?
When I was in junior high, I decided that I didn't actually want to be a professional ballerina. And so I was looking for an alternate career. Did a book report on radiation oncology. My mom was working as an office worker in some radiologist's practice. And so I got to go shadow for a day, and I thought, wow, this is a really nice way to blend science and helping people. I think I'll go into medicine. It was really pretty much that much of an epiphany. But also I was pretty naive. I mean, I come from a poor family and didn't know any doctors. So I had a general idea of what the pathway would be, but, you know, I had a lot of work ahead of me to make it so.
And so you went from studying biology and political science in Boston to Tulane to study. Is that right?
I did. I landed in med school in Tulane. So for a few reasons. One, I fell in love with Charity Hospital and the whole idea of, you know, the opportunity to learn and do good in a place like that. Secondly, I wanted to study public health and medicine. Tulane has a great dual program. And so it was a good opportunity for me to merge those worlds, even very early in my career. And I have some roots in New Orleans. I've got family from there. So it was a good way to kind of get closer to home.
Wow. And, you know, sort of playing this out in my head and some of the questions I was going to ask you, because I've known you for a little bit. There's so much stuff we can talk about. We can talk about sort of the here and now and what's sort of probably been there since the beginning of social determinants and public health to the time when I got to know you around interoperability at ONC. But I wanted to start with Katrina.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people know a little bit of the story. Some people might not know it at all. Mm-hmm. But take us back to then. It was 2005, I think.
It's 2005. It'd be 14 years this summer. And so I had gone to Tulane. And you and I were talking earlier about the easy glide path. I put myself through college. I had to get myself through med school. There was nothing perfectly seamless about my grown up and becoming a professional, but it was what I wanted so badly. The closer I got to practicing medicine, whether it was in med school or residency or whatever, the more I just fell in love with the whole opportunity to, I don't know, be part of people's lives and use my skills to help them. It was, and I think as I was practicing medicine over those years before Katrina, I kept running into the same challenge, which was that I could practice medicine really well, but there were a lot of other things my patients needed that I couldn't do, especially the ones that were, which was most of them, uninsured, low income. They needed help with, you know, transportation or understanding what to eat or being able to find healthy food. They had a lot of social situations that were really complicated. And so a great deal of the time when I was practicing medicine in the hospital or in the clinic, I was also trying to do social work and other things. And so when Katrina happened in 2005, it was this really interesting moment when a catastrophe opened some doors for us to create a healthcare system that would allow us to not only practice great medicine, but address the non-medical drivers of health. And I actually remember very vividly when those different moments happened and I saw the doorways opening. You know, Katrina was a storm that shut down our community for as much as a month. We were underwater, a landmass the size of the island of Manhattan. So a really big scale of catastrophe, and the duration of water that was in the foundations and the wiring and the plumbing of the buildings meant that it took us months to years to begin to build back. And in that period of time, when we were standing on the street delivering care from, you know, ice chests and card tables, and you're literally, you are in community meeting them where they are because there's nowhere else for you to work. This sort of realization of many things. One, that people, when they came to see us for medical care, even people with significant chronic disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, they were the first and foremost concerned about where they were going to live and if they could get a job and when the buses might run again and when their kids could get in school, all these non-medical drivers. And they looked to us for our expertise in medicine and public health to help them figure that out. And so I really had this important realization that as important as medicine was, that there were a lot of other things that mattered and that we had to help prioritize as leaders in the community in medicine. I think the second thing that became really obvious to me is as we were practicing medicine literally on the street without electricity or running water or anything, was we were doing it best when we were working in teams. That, well, we had volunteers who were social workers and nurses, others from professions like pharmacy, et cetera, people that we typically didn't work side by side with. And it was really clear to me really quickly that we could all do more when we worked in an aligned team. And I think the last thing that became really clear to me was that we needed to build a health system with community, not for them. And a lot of what we had in New Orleans, just like much of the country, was built around doctors and buildings and not about what people really first wanted to prioritize, things like mental health. And we really needed to listen carefully as we were building out the not only the infrastructure, but the policy frame. But it was I'm going to say gift, Keith, and that sounds terrible because people died and you know, 250,000 homes were lost. I mean, this was a huge disaster for our country and for the people it touched. But it was also a chance for me professionally and my community to hit the reset button and say whatever we were doing was getting us the worst health outcomes at the highest cost in Louisiana, and we needed to rebuild something that was going to be better for them. And it was an way to express the experiences I'd had as a doctor, but also what I knew scientifically as a researcher that we could do better.
So the irony in that, I was going to lead this for third, but I'm going to bring it up to first.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is because we're right on it. The irony of that is here you have this major catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that you're talking about, which is the immersion of care delivery with public health and social work, working in teams, mm-hmm. out of necessity, at the place that's most convenient for the patient, is ironically front and center in our healthcare world today.
I know, and I'm really excited about that. Yes, that so much of what we learned in New Orleans, and there's more. We did a lot with global capitation for primary care. We digitized the healthcare experience. There were a lot of things that have become front and center for the U.S. healthcare system, and I'm excited about that because I know deep in my soul and in my brain that it's the right thing for us to do as a country is to make that pivot. But I also know it's very hard. And the other thing I know about being very hard is when healthcare tries to do it alone, they will fail. It's too big of a challenge for just healthcare, and this is why it has to be done in partnership with others.
And so, when you think about that, and let's label it like everybody else is labeling it now, sort of the social determinants of health movement, mm-hmm. the terminology, the phrase of the year. There's always one or two every year. You know, is it a market, or is it just really about us rethinking the clinical delivery model? There's been a lot of noise lately in this space. So, and you and I have talked about it a lot over the last mm-hmm. couple of months. So I'm just curious sort of how you think about that as a market, if you will.
I think that the only way forward to find a sustainable business model that will allow this country to meaningfully and durably address the social drivers of health, we're going to have to find a business model that is part of a capital marketplace. The way we've been doing that work for generations is through public policy that provides grant funding or tax dollars to organizations that are chronically underfunded and therefore underperforming because they're under-resourced. And that's just not worked, frankly, for the country. I think we're going to have to really rethink the way that we can leverage 21st century tools and relationships and data to do something better, smarter, faster, and cheaper. And this is going to be as disruptive for the social care infrastructure as it has been, and the public health infrastructure as it has been for healthcare. But it's got to happen. We've got to digitize it. We've got to modernize the business infrastructure. There's going to be mergers and acquisitions. There's going to be disruptive technologies that come in and find better ways to provide transportation, food delivery, address social isolation. I think we're not quite there yet in figuring out what that funding looks like, and if all of it should come out of the pockets of medicine. I think there's good, important conversations about how medicine ought to have stronger partners. So maybe there's another opportunity for resourcing. But let me just give you kind of an example of one part of the social determinants portfolio that's potentially farther along, and that would be housing, where it used to be years ago, we would just provide grant funding or subsidize housing for families. And we have learned over the course of time how to leverage vehicles like new market tax credits to make it a more of a vibrant and part of the mainstream financial driver of a community, a way that there can be equity built not only for families and for, say, small community health centers and community development corporations, but that everybody's gaining and winning in this. And it's not just that the 1% are gaining. So I think that housing, there's some good lessons to be learned about how the merger of public and private sector policy and thinking of ways that we don't just give grant money to an existing system, but we try to build the business infrastructure of a social care system. And I suspect we're going to see more of that in other areas.
And how does that, I mean, how does that happen? And you've had the, again, the real world learning of Katrina and bundle payment there and different sort of city, state kind of thinking about how you do that. If you know, the thing that's also talked about a lot in this area is you look everywhere else in the world and you typically see sort of social care, community programs and health programs budgeting together. Where in the U.S. we have such separate polar opposites, and then it gets even more messy at the state level sometimes. And you're an expert in reimbursement as well, which helps, which is that where this ends up, where we to really make an impact here, we're going to have to start really following the dollar like everything else in healthcare? Or is there other things at foot here?
I think there's probably a few pathways that could emerge. And one of them could be that we create managed social care organizations in the way that we've had managed care organizations at the state level, for example, for Medicaid. It may be that we decide to take social care dollars mostly that are focused on the delivery of services to an individual, so what we would call downstream addressing social determinants, and find a way to blend and braid and or pool those dollars and put an entity at risk, which then creates a relationship between the person and that entity. They have an opportunity for better outcomes over the long run. That may be one business model that emerges. It may be that there are backbone organizations that emerge. We already are seeing some in the commercial marketplace and some that are maybe trying to be developed through the more public sector enterprise, a backbone organization that can take in individuals or communities and then hand out services. So when I say hand out, I mean make sure they get linked with services. So there are different versions of this emerging. I do think that HHS is going to need to put forward some demonstration projects, not so much looking purely at how Medicare dollars can support community backbone organizations, but how those healthcare dollars could be married up with, say, finance dollars from the housing sector or finance sector or other areas to kind of create these community backbone organizations. And I'm not sure that they need to be not-for-profit or public. They could be for-profit. I think we're still trying to find our way. But no matter what, I suspect that, you mentioned this healthcare social care investment in the U.S. notoriously spends a lot less on social care of our public dollars. It just in the way that we spend public dollars on healthcare, but it's managed in most of the way by the private sector. We may start to move into that in the social care system, and I think that all the innovation in the small, like I'm a company that does social isolation, I'm a company that does food delivery. Eventually, that's going to become an end to end service offering. At least that's the way I see it going.
And the other saying I say a lot is this idea of capitalism kind of running through the healthcare system. Do you see that playing out here? Yeah. And so, you think about some of the big fundings we've seen lately in the referral management space, or you've seen an acquisition in the referral management space already in social determinants, do you think that's what's going to jumpstart this as well? So you kind of have some reimbursement movements from CMMI, or even, you know, you're on the board of Humana, it could be from a commercial play. Or do you also see, obviously, you know, what I do for a living and others, private equity, venture capital coming into this, also try to jumpstart this out? And then, and ultimately, because we were in this discussion a month ago at our annual meeting, mm-hmm. when we had about 12 health system leaders and payers, was it's going to be a jump ball.
Yeah. So it is going to be a jump ball. And I mean, I think it already is a jump ball. And in some ways, that really got pushed by Congress in 2018 when it gave more latitude to Medicare Advantage plans to use supplemental benefits to pay for social determinants interventions. That was a mouthful. that really moved the health plans into the game, literally, of the jump ball. And healthcare systems that were in this work trying to decide if they wanted to build social care infrastructure, partner for it, you know, build, buy, or rent, or whatever they were going to do, the health plans are now also going after some of the same referral partners and digital platforms that help with referrals and et cetera. But I don't know where it's going to land, though I do think that the health plans have a real advantage here because they probably have more flexibility, not only Medicare Advantage, but Medicaid as well, in the way they can apply their dollars either in partnership or through purchasing services, but also because they theoretically have the right aligned incentives to keep people out of the hospital and keep them healthy, more so than most of the healthcare system, which is still pretty driven by head in the bed. And so I suspect that there's going to be more movement for a bunch of reasons. And my sense is that health plans, at least it's more than my sense, what I know of the industry is that health plans are much more deeply into this. And I would include in that, though, Keith, the integrated delivery networks. Right. They're very into this, as you know, because they've got global yep. budget and downside risk, just like the health plans.
Right. And so any forward-leaning in terms of what programs we may see? I mean, you have a little bit of an inside track in this area. You're doing some stuff with Levitt as well in this area. I'm curious, do you think it's going to be, you know, this barrage of programs coming out of CMMI? Do you think it's going to be kind of more of a slow organic roll? And then behind that, putting your kind of entrepreneurial innovators hat on, how should they be thinking about this market? Is it a market and should they be focused on this? Or do you think the big guys are really going to kind of drive this?
Well, as I sort of said earlier, I think I'm a little biased because I want to see it be a market because I think that that's the way that the country is going to be able to get its head around it. And I, by the way, we didn't talk so much yet about improving the context in public health, but there's a similar conversation there as well and the opportunities for partnership and improving health. And maybe later we can get to that some, but it's one thing to refer people to, you know, a housing agency to get assistance with finding the right subsidized housing. It's another thing to make sure a community has affordable housing.
Right.
And that's where I think the super forward-leaning healthcare systems and health plans are going. They're using their equity to build housing. They're finding ways that they can be a part of the solution set that's more contextual
yep.
and not just referral-based. But in the near term, I'm all for the downstream address the one person's issues because, first of all, that means maybe one less grandma goes to bed hungry or lonely. And that's a good thing for me from the perspective of a doctor. But I find that health systems and payers, as they get, as they try to address social needs, food insecurity, whatever, and they see that there are just lines and queues or under-resourced partners out there, it awakens them to the policy issues around the funding and the lack of infrastructure in the social care world. And again, I think that starts to create a conversation about partnership and policy and modernization of the social care infrastructure, which is, I think, where the country will need to go. But I also think, Keith, that if we really are going to try to reverse life expectancy decline and lower cost, and we believe in the data that social determinants drive 60% of health outcomes, and that they are, if you change social determinants, you can reverse the trends in cost and make care more efficient and effective and higher value, then we're going to need to find ways to address it, including through the healthcare system. And so you asked about HHS, clearly they've articulated publicly a couple of things. One, they definitely want to experiment. We started this in the Obama administration. They've carried it forward in the Trump administration. This is now a nonpartisan or a bipartisan idea that we need to understand how the healthcare system should be held accountable for addressing the social determinants, and Congress seems to be pretty in, right? They've approved some authorities that give additional latitude to Medicare Advantage. So that's sort of the experimentation CMMI place, and there will be more. You're seeing this in the declarations from the administrator, CMS administrator, about Medicaid, very public, about how important Medicaid is, how much latitude they want to give to states where that's possible. She's written about it publicly. I've talked to her about it. I mean, we know that she really sees there's an opportunity in Medicaid, but also in probably fee-for-service Medicare. So from the secretary all the way through CMMI and the administrator, there's a lot of publicly declared interest. But here's the one thing I want to mention about you're asking about solution sets in a market. One of the things the secretary said in his speech last November when he gave the speech on the root of the issue, the social determinants of health, is he said that the solution set's probably not a rifle shot, because people don't just come with one social need. They don't show up with just food insecurity. They typically also have transportation, housing, isolation. So whatever the marketplace is going to create, it is some kind of a backbone entity that can handle all of the social needs, and also has a pretty tight digital and analytic platform, because these are complex issues that can be teased out with data and analytics. But there's also needs to be, I think, a nimble system that can wrap the services around a person that they need. And it's going to take a mix of human touch plus digital plus a lot of community relationships. So I'm glad the secretary is pointing out that it's probably more complex than just a single solution set. And so I think companies that are trying to think about how to solve for all the social determinants are probably going to be more competitive, not just because he said so, but because it's probably the right direction to go. And I hope CMMI keeps going that way.
Yeah. And we've seen, like most early markets, we've actually seen a lot of unbundling, actually. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen sort of this sort of macro backbone player. We've seen transportation and a bunch of plays there be unbundled. We've seen food being unbundled a little bit, even housing and what some of the health systems are doing there more directly. It strikes me in your comments that that probably is where it goes. It's just, I mean, this is a really complicated issue. Mm-hmm. It would take a lot of capital. It takes a lot of reimbursement. And ultimately, it's going to take some business modeling kind of creation and being pretty creative in terms of how to really build all that. And I guess the one thing I'd ask you maybe to close up on this topic, and we'll move on to a couple others, is if you think about sort of we've talked occasionally about the health system being a platform, I mean, or the health plan being an integrated platform. This strikes me as one of those areas that may be the expansion side of it, really trying to bring that in. Do you agree with that? I mean,
I think that's the pathway that we're on. And I do think that the health plans, for a variety of reasons, probably could build a backbone and or more able to partner. I mean, for example, health plans are more often in people's homes than the healthcare system, especially in Medicare Advantage. And so we know more about their context immediately, not immediately, but because we have nurses and others going into the home, so you can see if they need a ramp or what the challenges are. The thing that the caution here, Keith, is about medicalizing the social determinants. And I'm of a couple of minds about this. As I said earlier, in the beginning of our journey here, if it means we've got to find a way to transfer dollars from healthcare to partners to help support the social care needs of those individuals in that individual level downstream, you've already got a challenge and we're going to address it. That's probably, from a business model standpoint, the easiest way to start. But over time, if we could figure out a way to have, you know, say, a social care and healthcare entity that go at risk together,
right,
for healthcare cost, I think
right,
that's a more viable long-term solution.
Yeah.
And it's not a feel-good, do-nice, let's work with the charitable organizations. But again, it's a job creation opportunity for the social care infrastructure. And So I think that we're on a little bit of a journey here, but I hope that we don't get ourselves so boxed into saying your health insurance provider is also going to provide your housing, because I don't think that that's the
right.
best.
We're seeing a couple of examples of that, which I find fascinating. And I think you said this in our meeting, which was, you know, what we don't want to do is we don't just want to run over a bunch of community organizations and social organizations. We need to figure out how to incorporate them, not kind of rewrite them and push them aside.
And or modernize them. I mean, this is where things get so tricky, right? is so many of them are small mom and pop shops that are working off paper still. And so they not only need probably additional resources of all sorts, but they're going to need to be transformed. And I go back again to what we did with CMMI and the way we've supported the healthcare infrastructure to modernize, digitize, change practice, learn how to do value-based care. We didn't take for granted that doctors and hospitals would figure it out or that ACOs would grow up out of nowhere. We, as a country, have provided billions of dollars in that investment.
Yep.
And if we want to get serious about this, we're going to have to figure out how to make the right investments in the current infrastructure, but more importantly, how to transform it to modernize it.
And those same level of complexities exist, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about, maybe we'll chat a little bit about interoperability next, but if you think about all the stuff that's going on there, but information sharing across community organizations, HIPAA, all different sort of complexities reside in this set of problems as well, maybe in spades.
Yeah, it will. And look, I think, by the way, about the modernizing that infrastructure, it may very well be that we'll find cases where it makes more sense to use rideshare or driverless cars than the old transportation infrastructure. So I don't have a particular pathway that I see that is clear. I just think what the country needs to get serious about is all the innovation and venture capital and digital investment is going strong, and I think it may very well become in many cases the dominant social care provider. But there is a question to be had about how we're going to still have those relationships on the ground. It's not right. Rideshare doesn't have some of the same relationships that others have. But yeah, there are a whole host of digital things. But yeah, here's what's kind of fun. Is even back in the ACA, there's a section 1561 that
you just like totally geeked out on.
Totally geeked out on you. And back then, they were thinking we're going to need to be able to exchange social care data. And the Office of the National Coordinator in 2010 actually took up section 1561 and wrote some recommendations on how to build a standards base and an architecture to support interoperability with social care infrastructure. And everybody forgot about it. And then Anish Chopra remembered it.
Right.
We've dusted it off and we're starting to look at it again. So there's already some pre-work. We had a lot of this actually in the interoperability roadmap that we wrote. So we don't have to start from scratch. And I think that's great.
Right. And that's a good segue. And so we got to know each other at ONC and talked a lot about interoperability back then, which was really like the groundswell back then. It was, we all were sitting around saying, yes, we need to do this, but there was nothing, there's no teeth. You know, obviously recently with the new CMS and ONC rules that are still kind of being baked, I think we're close to being baked. You know, what's your thoughts about back then to now? And it ties into this topic as well. And how far we've come?
Well, it's an extraordinary journey. And I think, you know, it was not without some pain, or a lot of pain, I should say, because we moved very swiftly as a country to digitize the care experience of everyone in the country. And we kind of overdid it, I say sometimes, because now everyone's got multiple electronic health records and the systems don't really talk. But we all have to remember that when, you know, high tech passed, we had the systems we had and it was stimulus money and the money had to go out the door quickly. And so harmonizing standards, it wasn't a priority for, I can't say exactly if it wasn't a priority because people didn't want to do it or because we didn't have time or probably a combination of both. But by the time I got to the Office of National Coordinator, it was pretty clear that we had done the adoption piece, the digitization component, but we were putting data into the systems and not able to get anything out. And that's kind of the interoperability story. And so it was a really nice moment for me to be able to step in to say, well, now we're going to think about how we're going to be able to use the data, make it available for folks. And it seemed, this is what's interesting about reflection, is that in 2014, when we rewrote the strategic plan for health IT, put the person at the center, talked about wrapping their data around them, move forward with the JSON task force to get the idea of APIs implemented in electronic health records, talked about how interoperability wouldn't just be direct B2B, but there would be a business-to-consumer opportunity. These were all big cultural shifts, and we linked that to delivery system reform. But I think what happened for us at the time was that we had the availability of new standards. We had FHIR just coming out on the scene, and that was a lighter technology. And now here, just even a few years later, I think we're smarter about, we don't even need to perfectly harmonize the standards of the data that's in there. We can actually make it useful just if we have the APIs, we'll make it available, and we can pull it and aggregate it. And so every year, technology gets better and better, and we're going to, I think, continue to be able to overcome some of the early mistakes that we made as a country in digitizing and not harmonizing the standards. But to do it again, who knows if you do it differently? The miracle is that we did do it, and now we have all this insight into the care we're providing, not providing, and how we can do better.
But let's assume the technical ways are there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk, you know, a little bit about, because you've been on the inside of politics for a while, at the city level, at the national level, state. How much of this is really about politics and the social system in time? So let's say that we finish off all the FHIR resources. Let's say we actually get the true interoperability. We have a couple of other different ways, from proprietary APIs all the way down to FHIR to HL7 V2. And we got different levels of connectivity that we think most days, most tacticians would say, technical mm-hmm. folks would tell you, most of our capabilities we have
tactician?
Today.
I like
it's a
it.
Terrible
it's
word.
It's great. I like it.
It's a wrong. It's not a word. How about that? Let's move over. Let's start that again. But technical folks would tell you that we're basically there already from a capability standpoint. So it's a two-part question, which is, how much of this is really about the social system and moving my cheese principle?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of this question is, do you think we potentially have, going back to our first topic, we could run into the same set of problems going back to social determinants given moving cheese?
Okay, so
there, I know.
Yeah, well, so first moving the cheese. We felt, when I was at HHS, we felt very strongly that we had to move the cheese, and that the data, the technology would enable that. So what moving the cheese meant for us was linking interoperability and certification of electronic health records to value-based care, and just changing the way that we paid for care in the country, and that would drive interoperability. What's interesting to see is that in a recent data brief that the Office of National Coordinator put out about physician behavior and interoperability, those physicians that are in value-based care arrangements, especially those that are in downside risk, are more likely to have interoperable health IT systems.
Go figure.
Voila. So this seems to be working. In fact, you know, I read the nationwide interoperability roadmap on the plane on the way here, just to make
you're like
sure.
Unveiling. I had a question here about what people don't need to know about you, but I've already uncovered it. We're not even going to ask it. Total political dork, geek.
Total geek. Just to make sure that we did say these things back then, and we did, and so that's the move in the cheese. Now, what you asked about the current rules that the administration put out, and this is they're moving the cheese of saying if you're going to – a condition of participation is to demonstrate that you're going to be interoperable. And it's a very particular way that they want there to be a notification that somebody's been in the hospital. But that we signal that in the roadmap, and it was signaled before in a report before I was national coordinator. So by the way, the healthcare systems had a bunch of signals from the policy environment in black and white and writing, this is coming, you need to be ready. And this administration said, it's here. And they've put it in the proposed rule. And I sure hope they don't back down. I hope that we keep moving forward, because that's to not be able to participate. Let me say the positive. If you're a 21st century healthcare system, you got to have 21st century IT. You've got to be interoperable. And that condition of participation in Medicare expectation, you can't get paid by Medicare unless you're interoperable, is a big move the cheese. We see sometimes little move the cheese, Keith, that happens during disasters. And So in a couple seasons ago, we had some big hurricanes, and you see that state HIEs and enterprise solutions, like the ones that are from the electronic health records, literally practically overnight find a way to interoperate, right, out to the benefit of people who are evacuated. And that there's now two or three recent stories of that happening. So that tells me again and again, it's about will. It's not about way.
Right.
And people just need to get over it. And so I'm over the moon excited about the pressure that this current national coordinator and CMS administrator are putting on the private sector to get going and be 21st century. And the private sector needs to catch up.
Yeah. And I think we'll finish there. And then one last question, but it's right where you started, mm-hmm. where it's like in these really disastrous situations, mm-hmm. somehow, some way, we can figure out a global arrangement. We can figure out how to get payers and providers to work together. We can figure out how the tech to work, figure out how to move the data. And like, that's a very telling lesson to your point, I think.
It is. Unfortunately, I don't think the country knows how to sustain the goodwill and the partnership that we seem to find in our hearts and souls and work in the time of disaster. One of the secret sauces of New Orleans, though, is that we did find a way to sustain that. Now, it took a lot of work. And in healthcare, it meant for me every day for about 7 years getting up and pushing the rock up the hill around healthcare and public health and things that we were working on. Someone's got to stay pretty focused on it, but you have to have a shared vision, a shared set of guiding principles, a shared way to work together that you can sort of point back to. But that civic engagement across not only healthcare for us or health, but across all sectors, I think is what has enabled New Orleans to come back. But figuring out how to then get other communities, there's something, Keith, about it's not about getting a community to say it's not about us and them. It's all of us in this. And that no matter how wealthy you are or privileged you are, you're never going to do as well if there's a big disparity in for the people who are in the lowest part of the income bracket. And we know that from data. I mean, that's just not a nice pie in the sky thing. I'm saying there's really good quantitative data from people like Raj Chetty that communities where they have a more narrow gap, everybody lives longer, everybody has more prosperity. So the goal then is that you not only raise the floor, but you close the mean and everybody does well, close the gap and everybody does better. New Orleans has figured that out. We're not alone, but I'd love to see the rest of the country kind of get their head around it. And this is part of the social determinants journey, frankly, as people step back in the healthcare system and say, oh, health is more than healthcare. Famous Dr. William Osler, who we all admire, said the good doctor treats the disease, the great doctor treats the patient, which is about context and humanity. Right. I think if we get some of that humanity back into the way healthcare and others are thinking about addressing health, we're going to be much more successful as we go forward.
Yeah. Dr. Penny Wheeler, from CEO and president of Allina, had brought that up as well, which is this idea of whole person care. Mm-hmm. And I just think this is why I'm so excited always talking with you and working with you, which is you've got such a perfect set of background right now from where you started in all this to where we are now, and to really have a much better perspective than most, frankly. And you know, I just think it's a privilege to be able to work with you and privilege to have the discussion today. And I just want to thank you again for your time, because I thought it was terrific.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for all the work that you have done and keep doing to keep pushing the system.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Please do share this episode. You can put us out there on Twitter or LinkedIn. If you tweet us out, you can tag me. I am at MedTechTom. You can also tag Keith. He is at Keith Figlioli. Figlioli is spelled Figlioli. We'd love to be part of the conversation. You can also tag us on LinkedIn as well. Also, if you haven't yet, please subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to make sure you don't miss a future episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders.